introduce you into the program, what's the best title to give you?
I guess the story, and I'm an adjunct at College of Western Idaho.
Yep. And
just one step above a janitor.
What's the title of your new book, and who's the publisher?
The title of the book is Lock, Stock, and Barrel, The Origins of American Gun Culture, published by Praeger, P-R-A-E-G-E-R.
Okay, and when's that being released?
It was released in February. It's available on Amazon.
Right. Okay, good, good. Look, I want to, unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to look at your book, which is difficult, but I have certainly been able to read some things about it and what I could find. But I just wanted to start, one of the sort of the things that I don't quite, into my head was that during the sort of battle for independence going right back to sort of 1775 in America, I'm wondering where the American colonies, whether they actually had any form of gun manufacturing at all before the before they gained independence.
They did. Generally, it was handcraft sort of stuff. Gun makers making small numbers of guns individually, often in response to a specific customer's request. It's certainly not an enormous industry, but it is present. There are a number of guns that survived from the pre-revolutionary period. And when the various colonial governments start to attempt to purchase firearms, they find there's actually quite a number of them available for sale that are domestically produced, and they also find that there are manufacturers willing to go ahead and make them. Maryland, for example, issues a number of contracts to various manufacturers for often 1,000 guns. And there's a number of, at least 10 manufacturers in Maryland that are manufacturing guns for the colony, and Pennsylvania has quite a number making similar numbers of guns for the colony. These guns are generally made on the pattern of the Brown Bess, which was the standard British Army musket of the time. There's also a significant rifle manufacturing industry in the colonial period, which persists well after the Revolution. And some of those rifles end up being used by the Revolutionary Army.
I was going to ask that during the sort of Revolution of Independence, because clearly for Britain it was very easy because Britain had a manufacturing industry,
right,
and it was connected to Europe. So I'm wondering, where did the colonies actually get their weapons from to defeat the British?
Well, initially an awful lot of them were actually, as I said, US-made, but what happens is, during the Revolution, the French government, as part of its campaign to pull the tail of the British lion, sells very large numbers of surplus French muskets to the revolutionary governments. Generally, these were being offered at prices that were so cheap that they were cheaper than American manufacturers could make muskets. This was a powerful incentive to buy French instead of having American manufacturers do this. The quantities involved also were substantial that the French government was able to supply. And, of course, this was a severe issue because throughout the war, there are manufacturing bottlenecks where many of the documents that I read indicate that manufacturers are saying, well, we're having trouble finding workers to work in our factory because often the harvest comes in, a lot of people go back to their farms to harvest their crops, or often people have been called away for military duty for one reason or another. And a lot of these manufacturers run into these obstacles in doing manufacturing for this reason, so buying from the French makes a lot of sense.
So once America gains its independence, was starting up or producing their own manufacturing industry, gun manufacturing industry, something that was of interest to the new American government?
Yes, it was. It's interesting. Thomas Jefferson, when he had been ambassador to France, had heard that there was a French gunsmith who was trying to get the idea of interchangeable gun parts perfect. So he had actually gone to see this guy, and the guy had demonstrated that he could take a number of parts for the gun lock, which is the part that actually makes the hammer come down. He could take the parts and basically put them together sort of at random, and end up with all working gun locks. And so one of the things that some of the early manufacturers under U.S. government contracts were saying, basically, we can make guns that will be so interchangeable that they'll be different pieces of cloth that will be cut from the same piece of material. In practice, this turned out to be a little harder than it sounded. Some of them did eventually resolve the issue, but it took a lot of work and a lot of time to reach this level of interchangeability. There's a guy named Hall who's generally considered now the person who best has the honor of having mastered interchangeable parts manufacturing for firearms. Although other people like Eli Whitney certainly contribute significantly to the task, he used to always get the credit for this, even though he had only a small part to play in it. It's interesting, though, that when Samuel Colt opens up his revolver factory, he starts out by going to Eli Whitney's son, Eli Whitney Jr., and has him help in setting up the factory and all the machine tools required to make revolvers in quantity.
So how much support did in those early years of the American Republic, how much of the gun industry was actually driven by the government, and how much was actually driven by sort of civilian demand?
Well, it's an interesting question because we know that there is a substantial civilian demand during this period, because an awful lot of visitors coming to America, especially from Britain, comment about almost everywhere they went, they find rifles and muskets being manufactured for civilian use. And we also know, however, that the U.S. government plays a significant role in creating the American gun industry. Some would say any more help like this and this industry could not have survived, because one of the things that the government does is they are at least as much interested in creating a new process of manufacturing as they are in actually getting guns. In many cases, they have contract limitations built into these contracts for buying muskets from the private industry that are actually quite destructive. One of them, for example, says that they're not allowed to manufacture for anyone else other than the federal government during the duration of the contract, which means in many cases, these companies basically, if they for any reason finish the contract prematurely, they are in no position to actually do any manufacture for anyone else. So in some cases, manufacturers get the misfortune of, at the time, instead of providing a blueprint with numbers marked on it, the government would provide what was called a pattern musket, which the manufacturer is supposed to use as something to make copies of, basically make a bunch of muskets that are just like this one. One particular manufacturer had the misfortune that the government had supplied him with a defective musket. It was not of the correct dimensions. This led to a sizable number of lawsuits where the manufacturer said, look, we produced copies of what you told us to make, and it was not, in fact, what you wanted. That's not our fault. And, of course, the government's response was, so what? It's your problem.
So what was the driving demand for the government? Why did the government want to produce so many weapons?
Well, during the Revolution, in fact, from the colonial period forward, the primary defense of the United States was supposed to be the militias of the various states. And theoretically, every member of the militia was supposed to provide himself with his own musket or rifle. From 1792 until 1903, the Militia Act of 1792 specified that every adult male under 45 every white male under 45 was required to arm himself with a musket or a rifle and have it in his home available for use that he was called out. Because at any moment you might be called out to provide defense against Indian attack, or more commonly, the major concern tended to be invasion by foreign powers. For example, when the British invaded during the War of 1812 and burned Washington, D.C. to the ground, the militia of Maryland showed up and did a very, very poor job of defending the capital from the British troops, but they did at least show up, and some people refer to it as the Bladensburg races, because Bladensburg is where this battle takes place, and so many people ran running from the scene. It was most embarrassing.
So by the time you get to around about the 1850s, the United States has emerged as a first-class or world-class arms manufacturer. And I'm just wondering, if you had to put that down to something, would that be that kind of demand from the government that, you know, every white male under the age of 45 has to have a gun, or was it civilian demand? What was the demand that really pushed America, I guess, to become such a world-class arms manufacturer?
There's an enormous civilian demand for guns. A lot of this is hunting related. In some rational sense, hunting doesn't make any sense because, for the most part, you're better off to raise your own livestock. But in practice, as it had been during the colonial period, hunting is a major entertainment activity for Americans. And in addition, one of the things a lot of people noticed when they came over from Britain, tourists in particular, was that hunting seemed to be a dominant force in almost all these frontier cultures, and even in a lot of the places that were not really on the frontier. Certainly, U.S. government demand did play a part in creating gun manufacturing. The interesting thing is it drove a dramatic improvement in the process for manufacturing. The machine tool industry, while much of the early machine tool manufacturing, things like the lathe, and then very importantly, Maudsley's development of the thread cutting lathe, provoked in America a dramatic improvement in the machine tool industry. Things like the horizontal mill and then the vertical mill and a variety of other tools used for metal manufacturing are largely American inventions, driven by the needs of the gun manufacturing industry to produce highly interchangeable parts. The theory being that if we provide all these parts, you should be able to repair or replace a part in an existing gun by just pulling it out and putting the new one in its place. This machine tool technology, in a lot of senses, creates our modern industrial world. Almost everything you're likely to actually have contact with is either machined directly by these sort of tools. For example, a lot of the parts of an engine block are actually machined that way, or they're things that are made by someone having used a machine tool to create a mold into which plastic is injected, for example, for a cell phone case. It's hard to imagine the modern world if these machine tools had not been developed.
So in lots of ways, you could say that the gun manufacturing in the United States was really the sort of, I guess, the jumping block for much of U.S. manufacturing that came in the latter part of the 19th and into the 20th century.
And not just the United States. It turns out that the Crystal Palace exhibition in London in 1851, I don't remember which year it is, there was an exhibit by Colt of some of their revolvers, and there were other manufacturers from the United States who were showing their ability to make interchangeable parts, and it had a dramatic impact on Britain. The British government sent over a number of engineers from the arsenals to look at how Americans made guns and ended up ordering up hundreds of machine tools from the United States to assist them in manufacturing British muskets using this new, more advanced method of interchangeable parts and machine tools. And from there, it sort of spread throughout Europe as well.
So I'm wondering what impact then the Civil War had on gun manufacturing, because in a way it must have almost turbocharged the industry, because the demands for guns and weapons would have gone through the roof.
Absolutely. In the case of the Civil War, the sheer quantity of guns that were required to arm the both the Union and Confederate armies was quite astonishing. It probably was far greater demand than the civilian market would have had before or after. Also, however, these improved manufacturing techniques so much reduced the price of guns that guns that might have been a little on the pricey side for the average civilian before the war, certainly it makes it a little bit more practical for you to buy a gun because of the fact that they're relatively inexpensive. Think of how dramatically the lowering prices of computers have expanded them from something that only a few crazy hobbyists had in the 1980s, like myself, to something that just about everyone has today. Mass production does wonderful things for pricing.
So what happened to all those guns at the end of the Civil War?
A fair number of them were certainly sold off by the government. I suspect an awful lot of them were actually taken home by soldiers. I mean, you had armies that were measured in the hundreds of thousands, and after the Civil War, the U.S. Army shrank down to its almost its pre-Civil War size, which was a few tens of thousands of soldiers.
What did that mean to the gun manufacturers? Because I'm imagining if you have an industry, I don't know whether, you know, how big it was at that time, but what happened to the actual industry and the makers of guns? Because the demand after the Civil War would have plummeted significantly.
Yeah, the civilian market probably fell back to its pre-Civil War levels. Some of the manufacturers like Remington were so impacted by the sudden reduction in demand. It's one of the reasons you'll, if you look carefully, you'll see the Remington brand name associated with all sorts of odd things like typewriters. Remington Rand used to be a fairly big U.S. manufacturer of typewriters because all the tools that made it possible to manufacture guns reliably and cheaply made perfect sense for an awful lot of other tools, awful lot of other consumer goods. This works the other way as well. During World War II, the U.S. government wanted a new, less expensive submachine gun, and they ended up eventually giving the contract to General Motors because the division of General Motors that made turn signal indicators on cars had a lot of experience with the stamping of metal, and so they were able to stamp out these the M3 submachine gun at an extremely low price because of the efficiencies that they had developed.
So in that post-Civil War period, I guess, in the lead up to the latter part of the 1800s, I'm just wondering, what was the level of civilian demand then for guns? Was it significant?
My book did not, for the most part, go after the Civil War, but I do know that there is a when looking through newspapers of the period, you find references to guns almost everywhere. It's quite common to search newspapers of that period and find literally hundreds of thousands of references to guns of various sorts over a period of 40 or 50 years. They are a fairly significant part of American life because a lot of Americans are still living out in frontier areas, and hunting remains, as it is today, a very important part of people's lives, primarily for entertainment, sometimes for food.
You, I know, disagree with the sort of line of argument that, in a sense, that the gun industry, if you look back historically, was primarily created by the US government. And I'm wondering, why do you think that is so wrong?
Because some of the historians that have claimed that this is largely US government creation, often the quality of their work, when you actually check the sources, is not very good. Also, that fact is there was an enormous civilian demand even during the colonial period. As an example, at one point in research for this book, I looked at a spreadsheet from the 1770s from the British Customs Office, and it showed that in the years 1769 through 1771, the United States imported, the American colonies imported more than 1 million pounds of gunpowder. I'm pretty sure that's a pretty good indication that Americans were buying using a lot of guns. That should have been enough by my estimates to have fired 12 million shots.
You also argue that much of the push, I suppose, for some kind of gun control originally had its, in its essence, something that was quite racist. I'm wondering if you can explain that.
Okay. In the colonial period, there's an awful lot of laws that are explicitly that blacks and Indians are to be disarmed. What's interesting is when they develop in places like Virginia, until the early 18th century, free blacks were expected to show up for militia duty and to be armed for it. In 1723, Virginia does something very interesting. They both prohibit free blacks from being armed for militia duty. From then on, if they show up for militia duty, they're going to be like using shovels, or they'll be the band. And the same year, they also take away the right of free blacks to vote. Something a lot of people don't realize is that free blacks in America at the very beginning were a little more numerous than most people would guess, and they had a variety of voting rights. Some of the other southern colonies actually had, there were complaints that blacks were still voting as late as 1701. There is a strong connection in American tradition between that citizenship includes, as one of the South Carolina decisions of the 1840s pointed out, they said, free blacks are not citizens. They may not vote, hold public office, or bear arms. It's sort of a sign that you really trust someone, that you trust them with weapons, and you also trust them to vote.
So what do you, I mean, I suppose when we look at the various debates today around firearms and the history of firearms, I suppose in a sense, what does the history, that early history of American gun manufacturers and firearms, what does that tell us and how does that inform the debate today, do you think?
I think it demonstrates that to a large extent, American gun manufacturing was heavily associated with the fundamental national identity that a free person could be trusted with a weapon, and if you could not be trusted with a weapon, you probably weren't really a free person. You were probably a slave or someone who was in some way considered a danger to society, like the Indians. Although the U.S. government did supply large numbers of rifles to many of the American Indian tribes as part of treaties that said, if you move west and give up these lands, we will supply you with blankets, food, gunpowder, and ammunition, and guns. Even today, to some extent, our gun control laws reflect this same notion of who can be trusted. U.S. federal law since 1938 with the Federal Firearms Act prohibits convicted felons from possessing handguns. Since 1968, prohibits them from possessing any gun of any sort or ammunition. Because felons are really not entirely trusted. Not surprisingly, a great many American states also prohibit convicted felons from ever voting again.
So of those early manufacturers, how, and I'm not sure if you know this, how many of those original manufacturers still exist today? And do we have any understanding of how large the gun manufacturing industry in America is today?
Well, Remington was founded by Ella Failet Remington, and they're still in business. I think they may have just gone bankrupt. If my memory serves me correctly, Winchester was founded in the period just before the Civil War, and they still continue to exist. And Colt, of course, continues to exist and manufacture guns in the United States. An awful lot of the early manufacturing in the early Republic period did not survive, at least partially because this is true of almost all companies in the United States. There are very, very few of them that have histories that go back hundreds of years. Some years ago, the Wall Street Journal had an article about American companies that whose roots go back before the American Revolution, and they found like 10 of them. The normal process by which economies grow and change means that an awful lot of companies that were present at one time tend to lose their edge, or for whatever reason, they end up either being absorbed by someone else or they just slowly go down the tubes. As to how many guns are manufactured in the United States, we actually have a pretty good idea because the U.S. federal government, the U.S. government has an excise tax that it imposes on every pistol, on ammunition, and on all long guns. And from that, the U.S. Treasury is able to produce reports pretty regularly that shows how many guns were made each year, how many were exported, and also how many guns were imported.
So do you have any idea of those numbers, how many are manufactured in the United States?
I don't immediately know the answer to that, but I do know that it is typically certainly millions a year. There's an enormous amount of demand for guns in the United States. Over the last 30 or so years, as our murder rates have dropped to levels we have not seen since the early 60s, a vast number of guns have been manufactured and sold. I was reading a court decision recently that mentioned that AR-15 and AK-47 pattern rifles have sold so well that they actually are more commonly sold than the most popular pickup truck in the United States, the Ford F-150. Over the last few years, something like 8 million rifles of those patterns have been manufactured and sold in the U.S.
From the outside, it's very hard because I suppose Australia never had the same gun culture. I suppose it's very hard to sort of get our heads around. And I'm wondering if you can kind of explain what the desire is, or the demand, where the demand comes from America to actually own a gun, and what does that mean for the kind of society America is, I guess?
There are several significant reasons why people buy guns. The most common one is self-defense. And in many American big cities, that concern is quite understandable. Violent crime in the United States, and murder in particular, is not evenly distributed across the United States. It is concentrated in a few big cities. Places like where I live in Idaho, there was a shooting in the north end of the state, and it was a major news story on local stations here. Generally, murder is fairly rare in Idaho and many of the other western states. In fact, what's interesting is that murder is rarer in Idaho and many of these other Rocky Mountain states than they are in the Canadian provinces to our immediate north. Some cases like Manitoba, it's quite common for there to be 50% more murders per population in Manitoba than there is in the immediate adjoining state of Minnesota. A second reason why demand for guns is high is hunting. There's still an awful lot. There's several million people that regularly hunt in the United States. And contrary to the image that many people like to see American hunters as, they are generally 4 years of college or more, and they're generally fairly high income. I was quite surprised myself when I was finding statistics that the Fish and Wildlife Service keeps on this, that a sizable fraction of hunters have incomes above $100,000 a year. And a fair number have graduate degrees. I'd say the third factor, the one that drives an awful lot of demand for AR-15s and AK-47s pattern rifles, is that there is a long tradition in the United States of not entirely trusting our government. Certainly one of the major concerns that shows up in the debates about the adoption of the new Constitution is, what are we going to do if this new government that we're forming gets out of control? Many of the concerns that they had about the British government, they perceived that there was some risk that this could happen with this new national government that was being created, that it might have too much power and might misuse that power. This is one of the reasons that when the new Constitution was ratified in 1789, many of the states requested a Bill of Rights to protect individual rights that they did not feel they felt might be in danger from the new national government. And the single provision that was the most requested was a right to keep and bear arms. Five of the 13 states, when they ratified, specified they wanted such a guarantee added to the Constitution. And they were successful in getting that. The Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is the one that guarantees the right to keep and bear arms. There is a certain mistrust that that a strong national government might get out of control.
One of the things that's interesting is if you do look at polls across the United States, there is a sense that the majority of people would like some kind of gun control, and yet that doesn't seem to happen. And so I'm wondering whether or not there's also the sort of the politics of gun manufacturing, of the NRA now, the National Rifle Association, means that the gun manufacturers themselves have a sort of unique, powerful position politically in terms of how they're able to influence politics across the United States.
One thing that's important to remember is a lot of those polls is that an awful lot of Americans have no idea what gun control laws are already there. remember some years ago when I lived in California, one of the large polling organizations there asked Californians, do you think there should be laws prohibiting the mail order sales of guns? A strong majority said yes. The problem is it was already 30 years too late. The Gun Control Act of 1968 had already prohibited mail order sales of guns. There's also often a shortage of data. There's generally widespread support for some sort of requirement that all private sales of firearms go have a background check, ostensibly to prevent criminals from obtaining guns. But interestingly enough, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has studied this problem of criminally used guns for some time. They've discovered that most of criminally misused guns are obtained by methods that are already felonies, things like burglary and what are called straw man sales, where someone who cannot legally buy a gun sends someone who can legally buy a gun because they would pass a background check into the gun store to buy the gun for them. The number of purchases of criminally misused guns in private sales is actually surprisingly small. The so-called gun show loophole is one of those examples. About 0.1% of the criminally misused guns were obtained from gun shows. So, as I said, there's an awful lot of people who hold strong opinions without any actual data to back them up.
So what's your sense in terms of the current debate? Because clearly after the most recent school shooting there seems to be a clear divide in America between the people that want greater gun control and people who don't. And I'm just wondering, how do you think that debate is likely to play out? And is it in a sense a debate that's been going in America for the last sort of 20, 30 years?
It's been going on for 20 or 30 years. I'm not really quite sure how the result is going to be. I suspect that we will probably succeed in preventing any substantial change in the gun control law simply because the existing laws actually are fairly effective when anyone bothers to obey them. As an example, this mass murder that happened in Texas a few months ago, this was a case where the Air Force had gone ahead and convicted this guy of a felony and had also involuntarily committed to a mental hospital. Both of these are firearms disqualifiers that if the Air Force had actually reported these to the appropriate agencies, what would happen is that both of these would have prevented him from being able to legally buy a gun. So until people actually are prepared to see our government actually do what it's supposed to do, I'm not sure there's much point in passing any more laws.
So you think that if most of the laws were actually followed, that many of the sort of shootings or school shootings would not have occurred?
At least some of them would not have occurred. The larger issue, the one that does not get very much attention, is that this sort of problem was not substantial when I was young. When I was in the 1960s, I can remember one substantial mass murder incident, and that was at the University of Texas. It involved a guy named Charles Whitman. One of the things that changed is in the 1960s and 1970s, across the United States, a series of both legislative decisions and decisions that were enforced by the courts basically destroyed the state mental hospital systems that we had. In 1960, if you were making statements that indicated you were having hallucinations and thought that the government was out to get you or that Martians had landed, there was a good chance you would be hospitalized and very likely involuntarily committed, meaning you would have been held to that hospital until the doctors decided you were well. And when the Gun Control Act of 1968 was passed, one of the mental health provisions said that if a person had been involuntarily committed to a mental hospital, then they could not legally possess a firearm, and that's still part of the background check system. In 1968, it was still the case that in most states, if you were obviously dangerous to yourself or to others, you would be involuntarily committed. But starting in 1967 in California and in the 1970s in most of the rest of the country, those involuntary commitments became extremely difficult to obtain, and an awful lot of people started to wander the streets, often much of the homeless population that began to develop in the 1970s and 1980s were people who had previously would have at least had a dry, warm place to sleep and a meal. And unfortunately, some of these people ended up becoming substantial headlines when They go on a rampage. The guy that really started the current assault weapons panic in 1989 was a guy named Patrick Purdy in Stockton, California. He had been determined by authorities on a number of occasions to be dangerously mentally ill. He had been charged with a number of felonies, which were then plea bargained down to misdemeanors. If he had been convicted of any of the felonies, he would not have been able to legally buy a gun. If he had been involuntarily committed, even after his release, he would not have been able to legally buy a gun. And, of course, because of the fact that they did not really do what they were supposed to do, and an awful lot of people who are seriously mentally ill end up committing a lot of these mass murders. Mass murders in the United States basically fall into three categories. There usually are people who have severe mental illness problems. There was a guy who shot up the U.S. Capitol in 1999. He was convinced that cannibals had taken over the U.S. government and that there was a device inside of the U.S. Capitol called the Ruby Satellite Controller that would enable him, once he got hold of it, to turn back time. He killed a couple of police at the entrance to the Capitol trying to get to this satellite controller. And, of course, at trial, it was determined that he was mentally ill. But this is also a person who had had a series of mental health hospitalizations which had never led to any long-term commitment in his home state of Montana. And there's an awful lot of these in that category. The second category, which tends to be ignored, are basically domestic violence situations where often a husband has some sort of temperamental issue and ends up murdering his wife and kids. Sometimes these are divorce-related. Sometimes they're not. These are, in fact, a big fraction of the mass murders in the United States. They get very little attention because they often take place in a home. They don't have large numbers of screaming mothers. A lot of them are involve black families who, to American news media, in a sense, don't really exist. The third category of mass murders tend to be terrorist attacks. Those are not very common, but some of them, like San Bernardino, a couple year or two ago, get a lot of attention because of the fact that there were so many people killed. What's interesting is that mass murder is actually pretty common in a lot of other countries. Even when it doesn't involve firearms, it does often involve these same patterns. Australia, for example, has had a number of mass murders the last several years involving blunt objects, automobiles, and fire. And this is true in most European countries as well. Until this incident in Florida, the largest mass murder in a K-12 school was in Erfurt, Germany. France has also had quite a number of mass murders, as has Finland. In the case of Finland, it is definitely a frontier gun sort of culture. In the case of France, these are typically mass murders by people with serious mental illness problems. Japan and China, both amazingly enough, in spite of fairly restrictive gun control laws, tend to have a significant number of mass murders, although these are often done with knives or meat cleavers. So, as I said, the United States is not particularly unique in terms of mass murder. We're only a little bit unique in how often it's done with guns.
Look, Clayton, that was very interesting. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you think I probably should have asked you in terms of trying to understand the history of it?
Actually, no. You've asked all sorts of really useful and interesting questions.
Thank you very much. Listen, thank you very much for coming in. The sound quality on the studio is always much, much better. Look, this is going to go to air in a couple of weeks, and when it does, we'll send you a link and you can have a listen online.
Okay, I really appreciate that. I mean, I've done an awful lot of these interviews over the years for various books of mine, but it's got a little bit more unnerving. I had a stroke in 2014, and there are parts of my voice that really don't work quite as well as they used to.
Yes, yes. Funnily enough, my mother had a stroke 2 years ago, and it affected her balance and also her swallowing and her voice. And so her voice, she now sounds a bit like Marlene Dietrich, and she has...
Does she now look like her?
Well, she's in her 90s, so not quite. She's very fashionable, but not quite like Marlene Rodrigue. And she has the problems that she has is she gets the getting rid of the saliva.
Right.
That she's with her throat not working. She finds it incredibly difficult and frustrating.
My neurologist says swallowing issues usually are because of a bihemispheric stroke. In my case, I had one in 2015 that affected both sides of my brain.
Oh, right.
It disabled me from my old job of software engineer.
Right.
So now I'm reduced to teaching and writing books because those don't require anywhere near as much brain power.
Right. Well, your brain didn't seem to be affected at all to me. Anyway, listen, thank you very much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
No problem.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Got that all recorded for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, what's a good way to get that to you? I mean, we can do a link that we can send to an email account or.
Oh, a link would be fine.
Okay.
I can download it just fine.
Perfect. I can go ahead and take care of that then.
I think my wife must have run off because her phone rings.
She was horrified. What? That her phone went off. Yes.